Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Stephanie C. She's a media coordinator with a Montana-based Buffalo Field campaign, the only group working in the field, in the courts, in the policy arena in defense of the country's last wild migratory buffalo, the Yellowstone population. Stephanie's been on the front lines with BFC for 15 years, and from the direct interactions and experience with these gentle giants, she and her comrades have come to the understanding that while we may be trying very, very hard to save the buffalo are desperately trying to teach us to save us from ourselves. So first, as always, thank you for your wonderful work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here with you again.
Thank you. So why don't we start with an introduction to buffalo and prairies and migration, and then move to the Buffalo Field campaign after that. So tell us about buffalo, prairies, and migration.
Buffalo. Well, buffalo are native to North America, to Turtle Island. They are the largest land mammal on this continent. They once existed in the tens of millions, upwards of 70 million, roaming from northern Canada down to Mexico, all the way as far east to Appalachia and almost to California. So they covered the continent, and they essentially created the continent. They are a migratory species, meaning they move with the change of the seasons and the availability of food. And in doing so, they helped create the prairies and the grassland ecosystems. They're really woolly. Their fur is really woolly, and so they would help to carry seeds around in their fur. And their hooves are two-toed ungulate, and so their hooves gently till the soil and help the seeds get planted and help the soil germinate. And wallowing is something that buffalo do. They roll around on the ground, and in doing that, they create these divots in the earth that during the spring rains, I mean, imagine millions of these wallows all over the prairies, and the rains come, and they fill up with water and create temporary habitat for birds and aquatic animals and others. They are a keystone species. They have a very strong symbiotic relationship with prairie dogs. Prairie dogs tend to like the way that buffalo graze and keep the grasses short enough so that the prairie dogs can feed. They're super beneficial. Obviously, the earth chose them. And once upon a time, there were tens of millions. And now the last wild buffalo population has been driven down to about 3,600 individuals.
So before we move on, I've got a few specific questions. One of them is, I don't remember if I've ever asked you this before, that when we say migrate, did an individual bison, I mean, as a herd, would one bison move all the way from Yellowstone down to Texas, or would a buffalo who summered up in Montana maybe move down to Wyoming, and one who summered in Wyoming move to Colorado? Did they move a little bit, or did they move the whole way down?
We don't know, because as soon as the colonizers got here, they started killing them off, so we don't really know. And from our observations, I would say probably not. There were probably just different family groups and different herds that would use different areas at different times of the year. I don't think, one particular herd would travel from Virginia all the way to Montana, for example. So that's the best that I can answer that question.
And then the other one is, we did this math before, but let's do it again. That how long would an average buffalo live in the wild back then, do you think? And what would be the individual lifespan?
Back then, probably upwards of maybe 20 years, 15 to 20 years.
Okay, so if we have 70 million buffalo and they live 20 years... That means that there's, 3.5 million dead buffalo per year? And then if each buffalo weighs, 2,000 pounds? How much do they weigh?
Yeah, mature bulls weigh 2,000 pounds.
Okay, so to make the math easy, we have 3.5 million dead at 2,000 pounds each. Is my math right that that's 7 billion pounds of meat?
Maybe, because you're asking the wrong person. I really suck at math.
Well, let's see. 3.5 million dead, and if they weigh 10 pounds each, that's
right.
35 million. They weigh 100 pounds each, that's 350 million. Yeah, That's my point is that I've read accounts, and this just breaks my heart. I've read accounts of packs of wolves in Texas when the Europeans first arrived. There would be hundreds and hundreds of wolves in one large pack. And the only way they could do that, of course, is if they have a lot of food. So this is just a tremendous, as well as all this planting they're doing, they're also feeding everybody. You know, I talk a lot about how salmon feed forests. So we could just say the same thing here, that the buffalo are not only tilling the prairie, they're not only helping the prairie to germinate, but they're also feeding everybody and their cousin.
Exactly. And I mean, it's just a massive amount of biomass, those bodies on the ground. And grizzly bears and buffalo evolved together in a way that, they're dependent upon each other. I mean, grizzly bears right now are having to turn more and more to buffalo. They've always eaten buffalo, but now they're having to turn more and more to them because their other food sources, like the army cutworm moss, little Yellowstone lake trout, are disappearing because of climate chaos. And so and we'll talk about this later, but with the buffalo slaughter that's taking place and grizzly bears being in an endangered status, even though they lost protections, that biomass is being removed from the landscape, and that's further harming grizzly bears, and it's further harming wolves. And today, though, I mean, wolf packs aren't quite large enough. It takes a lot for a wolf to take down a buffalo. Sometimes they're successful, a lot of times they're not. But once upon a time, you know, the buffalo, they fed everybody, including the earth herself.
Well, and honestly, yeah, they could take down a buffalo. I mean, a hundred wolves could probably take down a lot of things, but they would also need to, because if you have that many buffalo, you're going to have them dying of just old age. You know, they'll be dropping off. I've read of counts of herds of buffalo that would take literally days to pass. Okay, I'm going to back up a second. I was a beekeeper when I was in my 20s, and there might be 100,000 bees in the summer in a colony. And I got really freaked out my first year that I was doing bees because I saw all these dead bees all over the place. Until I did the math, and bees in the summer live about a month. So if you have 100,000 bees and they live a month, you're going to have 3,000 dead bees a day.
Right.
And it's the same with this. And if you have 70 million buffalo, you're going to have a lot of them are not going to be dying by overt predation. They're just going to be, you know, having a heart attack or, you know, just dying of old age. They'll be falling asleep and not waking up. And then the herd moves on and everybody gets a treat.
Exactly.
So
what a gift.
Yeah, what a gift. So let's talk about just for a few minutes about the collapse of buffalo populations. I should say the extermination, not collapse. And then move to focus on Yellowstone.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are familiar with the shameful history of the settler colonization of this continent, and when the U.S. Army was at war with the indigenous people here, the buffalo cultures in particular, they targeted the buffalo because they wanted to ensure if they killed their food source, if they're, you know, not even just food source, the buffalo was everything, then they could more easily subjugate and harm the people and control them. And so as through an act of genocide, millions and millions of buffalo were killed within almost less than 10 years. I mean, they were killed over a course of a longer period than that, but when the buffalo wars really first started happening in the mid-1800s, it didn't take long for these buffalo hunters, the army, to nearly wipe them out. And they almost succeeded. And luckily, there were 23 individual buffalo, 23, who sought shelter in what is now Yellowstone National Park's Pelican Valley. And the irony is that they were later discovered by the U.S. Cavalry, who came in then to protect them because they realized the big mistake that they had made in nearly wiping out the buffalo. So in part, Yellowstone National Park was created to protect these last remaining wild buffalo. And there were a couple of remnant small little family groups, one in Montana and then one down in Texas, that were protected by a few different people who actually, you know, they saw what was taking place. They saw the buffalo disappearing, and so they protected these little groups, and they ended up bringing them to Yellowstone. And so you ended up, the 23 individuals who saved themselves are has become the central buffalo population, the central herd, and then you have the northern herd, which was kind of supplemented by these others who were brought in. And today, the central herd is in extreme peril. There are fewer than, we don't even know how many there are. Last year, going into the season before Yellowstone started killing, there were about 847 buffalo left in the central herd, and 1,200 buffalo were killed this year. And the central herd is unique because they migrate both west into the Hebgen Basin in Montana and also north into the Gardner Basin in Montana. And so as that happens, they are doubly impacted by the management actions that are taking place on the edge of Yellowstone National Park.
So let's talk about the migration and the modern killings. Actually, before we do that, let's talk about what was the history between the formation of Yellowstone Park and, let's say, the founding of Buffalo Field Campaign. What happened? What was going on with the buffalo, say, in the 1940s?
That's Yellowstone buffalo. That's a good question. I don't know, actually. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'll have to have you back for another interview where we talk about that.
Okay.
Okay. So, but to bring us up to the present, then, so the herd was protected. The two herds were protected in, you know, 100 and some years ago, and then Buffalo Field Campaign comes onto the picture. Why?
Well, because as the population started to grow, so Yellowstone National Park, let's just back up a little bit, is located on a really high elevation plateau. Some of the land in there is about 8,000 feet. And even the lower elevation in Yellowstone is about 6,000 feet. So the winters are pretty intense, and the snow gets very, very deep. And while buffalo are well equipped to handle winters like that, and they can also, it's called cratering, where they use their huge heads that are supported by their humps to move the snow aside to get to the grass below. Sometimes it gets far too deep for them, and they have to leave, just like everybody else who eats grass. They have to leave and seek lower elevation habitat. So when their migration routes take them through, again, west into the Hebgen Basin into Montana, and north into the Gardner Basin into Montana. And Montana currently is politically a very powerful cattle state. The livestock industry pretty much runs the show throughout the state. They're kind of a vocal minority. They act like they're the majority, but they have a lot of control over everything. And because buffalo are the native bovine, the cattlemen don't want to share the grass. They don't want to see the restoration of the buffalo. They don't want them coming into Montana. And so they have waged a war against them. It's a war that's continued. It's never really stopped. But now the wild buffalo are trying to make a comeback, and Montana is responding with killing, with the aid, the intense aid of Yellowstone National Park. So in 1996-97, there was a pretty intense winter. The snows got very, very deep, and then there was a warming period, and then it got cold again. And what happens to the snow then is that it can turn to concrete. And, I mean, literally sometimes you can even see buffalo walking on top of snow when the conditions are like that. And there is no way that they can crater through that, so they have to go to other places. And so a lot of buffalo migrated into Montana that particular winter, particularly in the Gardner Basin, and over 1,084 buffalo were killed by Montana and Yellowstone National Park because of that migration, and a thousand more or so died from being winter killed, just being killed because the winter was so difficult. And Mike Meese, who you know, he's an activist, videographer, and he was working for an organization called Cold Mountain, Cold Rivers, and was aware of what was going on and had gone over to Gardner, gone over to Yellowstone, and was documenting what was happening, and was just like, you know, very concerned and freaking out and knowing that something had to be done. And so he sent the footage that he was getting to various tribal leaders, and Lakota Elder Rosalie Little Thunder responded, and she ended up coming out, and together they decided that there needed to be a presence on the ground to bear witness and to stand in defense of the buffalo and to let people know what was taking place there. And that's essentially why Buffalo Field Campaign formed. And by April 1997, we had found a place in just outside of West Yellowstone, Montana, and that's where we've been based ever since. And our job is to run daily field patrols, monitoring the buffalo's migration, and documenting all actions that are made against them, advocating for them in the courts, in the policy arena, in the field, using all the tools in the toolbox. So we are on the ground with the buffalo every day that they are migrating into Montana, and that typically, with the weather, tends to be around from November through May into June. And then by June, typically the buffalo, now that we have gained some year-round habitat and hazing has really diminished, we see that they naturally migrate back towards their summer habitat in Yellowstone for after their calves are strong and right before the rut season begins when they have their big family reunions. So
before we talk about what's going on sort of in the last year, there's another question I want to ask, which is that sometimes they migrate, when they're migrating, sometimes it's through wildlands, and don't they also sometimes migrate through areas with human populations? And, you know, you know me, and you know that I see bears essentially every day, and I love seeing bears, and I just have to say that if buffalo were native to this area, I would be overjoyed to look out my window and see some buffalo walking past. And if we ignore the ranchers and just talk about normal human beings, just regular people, do most people, when they see a buffalo walk past their house, are they happy or do they hate them? Or somewhere?
Most people are stoked. They are super stoked, and it's why they ended up choosing to live where they do. And we have one incredible example out on a peninsula called Horse Butte, which is part of the Gallatin National Forest public land and part of its private land where there's a subdivision. Little acre lots, houses, subdivision. And this also happens to be part of the buffalo's winter range and calving ground. And so either in the winter or in the spring, you can tend to have hundreds of buffalo out there. And this subdivision, Hebgen Lake Estates, Yellowstone Village, is it's the perfect living example, perfect classroom of coexistence. People love the buffalo. They get so excited. They'll have buffalo bedded down in their yards. They'll have buffalo walking through the neighborhood. You'll see kids playing while there's buffalo, grazing in, 15 feet away. People out walking their dogs. Buffalo bedded down, grazing around yards. It's just amazing. And people love it. They get excited all the time when the buffalo arrive, and they get sad when they go. So that's the real world. You get all these crazy people out there who've never been around a buffalo or think they know everything and talk about how dangerous they are and how you can't live with them and they're not like other animals. It's like, well, no, they're not like others. They're a buffalo. And so you learn how to live with them as who they are. And even in this neighborhood, if there are issues, which there's never been any kind of dangerous issue, but say, buffalo get really itchy in the springtime because they have all that thick wool and it's starting to get hot and they shed, and they like to rub on trees or rocks or anything that they can find. And, some people don't want buffalo rubbing on their trees. So what do? They put a fence around their tree. Problem solved. Now the buffalo can rub on the fence and the tree's good and everyone's happy. So it's like, when will the human understand that, just because there's a large bovine that's walking through your front yard, it doesn't mean it's a problem. It means that you have an opportunity to learn how to live with this other being who was here long before you. It's, for the human to change, and yet the humans are always trying to make everybody else change to suit them. But anyway, so yeah, Horse Butte has an incredible example of buffalo friendly habitat in a place that is pretty well populated by people, by humans. And the same in the Gardner Basin, it's kind of not quite as pro-buffalo, but there are definitely lots of friends of buffalo, and it's getting stronger over there. They don't have the same year-round habitat over there as they do in the Hebgen Basin, but we're working on that. And then one thing, though, that did happen in the Hebgen Basin, there had been a large tract of private land called the Galanis, well, owned by the Galanis family. It was close to about 700 or so acres, and buffalo-friendly. You know, lots of grass, just huge rolling hills of grass, and the buffalo love it. That land just got sold, and the Buffalo Safe Zone sign that was there has been taken down. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know who these owners are or how they are going to treat the buffalo, how things are going to change, but hopefully they will have a clue that their surrounding community are staunch supporters of wild buffalo, and if things go badly for them there, that they're not going to be very popular. But it was a big blow to lose that land and see those signs come down. We don't know what's going to happen.
So I want to ask about what has happened in the past year or so since we did an interview. But there was a question I was going to ask earlier and I forgot. So I'm going to jump out of order here. And I don't know that you'll know the answer to this, but you talked about buffalo cropping land or cropping the grasses down such that the prairie dogs like that they eat them short.
Because they can see better.
Yeah. And the question I have is, so what is the relationship between buffalo and tall grass prairie where there were grasses that were like 7 feet tall? Is that because the buffalo might migrate through only once every 5 years or something? Or how do we have them eating it down to a couple inches and then also the existence of grasses that are 7 feet tall?
That's another really good question, and I don't know the answer to it, so there's a little bit more research to be done. But I don't want to actually even speculate or make things up, but maybe the tall grass prairie, I don't know. I'm not even going to go there because I don't know enough to answer that question.
Well, I'm a guy, which means that I get to just make shit up.
Okay, go ahead.
And so what I'm going to say, and once again, this is pure, I'm just completely talking out of my behind, but I think it's because the buffalo would alter their migration path every year such that, and when they have the whole prairie to work with, such that they might only go through an area for once every 5 years, once every 10 years. But I'm making that up.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible. And again, it's like maybe somebody knows, but how could we possibly know what they really did, because that memory is lost because they were killed as soon as contact was made, you know? And the people who knew them, who lived with them, who were their relatives, those memories are lost.
Well, this makes me think of two things. One is I interviewed Vine Deloria back in the late 90s, and one of the things that he said to me, he was a Dakota man. One of the things he said to me was that it was, at that time, a very critical time for the Dakota people, because the last people were now old who had ever spoken with the last of the Dakota people who were born free, were
right.
Dying. So basically people who had been alive in 1870 were dying in 1935, and they had a little bit of an overlap with the people who were dying in 2000, so it's the last people who had direct contact with those who were never conquered.
Right.
And that's one thing I want to mention. The other thing I want to mention is that my mother is 86, and she often tells me about her stories about her grandmother, who grew up on the prairie in Nebraska. And I don't know if I ever told you the story that when my mother's grandmother was a little girl, she would get scared every time there was a lightning storm, because there were so many buffalo around that she was afraid that the buffalo would stampede and run over their sod house.
And yeah, I remember you telling that.
How beautiful is it that you have a little girl, and it never happened, of course, but there were enough buffalo to worry about that.
I know.
That just brings tears to my eyes. And that's, you know, my mother's 86, and she spoke with her grandmother, and she is the last person of that generation who spoke with her grandmother who knew, the same as Vine Deloria, who knew free bison, who knew free buffalo.
Right?
Buffalo who'd never been conquered.
Amazing.
Okay, so now let's go back to the present where we don't have so many buffalo, or there aren't so many buffalo. And before we talk about what's happened in the past year, can you talk a little bit about the so-called hunt?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's more than that, what's going on. So I spoke a little bit about Montana's intolerance, the cattle industry's intolerance. Let me just put it this way. The Montanans at large, the general population, around 80% support wild migratory buffalo. I just want to put that out there. It's the livestock industry in Montana that's driving all of this madness. So when that migration happened and all those buffalo were killed, Montana had also sued Yellowstone for allowing, if you can believe that, for allowing wild buffalo to migrate into Montana. And throughout the court process, they ended up having to come up with a compromise, a plan, which became the Interagency Bison Management Plan, which was crafted largely by cattle interests. It serves no beneficial purpose for wild buffalo whatsoever. It's a state, federal, and tribal plan. And so under that plan, buffalo may be captured for slaughter and shipped to slaughter. Buffalo may be shot when they leave Yellowstone's boundary today by hunters. It used to be by the Department of Livestock. They may be rounded up and captured for quarantine, which is a domestication process that basically turns buffalo into livestock. So yeah, there's a lot going on, and the trap that exists today, that is in use today, is in the Gardner Basin, inside Yellowstone National Park, run by Yellowstone National Park. It's the Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap, and while there is excessive hunting that takes place on Yellowstone's north and west boundaries, especially the north boundary, the trap has killed more buffalo than any hunting that has taken place. And Yellowstone has the most blood on their, buffalo blood on their hands than any agency now. Any. And even the Montana Department of Livestock. The Montana Department of Livestock doesn't even really participate much anymore because they've got Yellowstone doing all of their dirty work and Yellowstone going about it like it's business as usual while they wear buffalo on their badges.
And the point of a park, by the way, let's just be explicit. One of the points of a park is the preservation of wildlife, supposedly.
And one of the mission statements is to preserve, and I hate to use this word, resources, to preserve unimpaired. So that's not working. Yellowstone's not doing that. They are systematically destroying these last wild buffalo. And I'm not going to speak to it because you had such an awesome interview with BFC's habitat coordinator, Daryl Geist, about the central herd. But the central herd, just briefly, is in such dire straits that going into this winter, and I mentioned that the central herd migrates both north and west, Yellowstone National Park said that they recommended there be no hunting on the west side because it's exclusively the central herd members who migrate in that direction. Yet they went ahead and captured for slaughter hundreds of buffalo, not even knowing which herd they came from, when they migrated into the Gardner Basin. So Yellowstone was saying, hey, this population is in big trouble. Why don't you hunters take the conservation burden, and meanwhile, we'll just round them up and kill them like it's business as usual, no big deal. And so now we don't even know how many buffalo remain in the central herd, because we do know hundreds were killed on the west side, and those were all from the central herd, and then hundreds and hundreds more were killed on the north side, and many of those were also from the central herd.
So tell me more about what has happened, bring people up to date since our last interview on some of the things that have happened, newsworthy things that have happened regarding the the Yellowstone buffalo in the past year.
Okay. Can I start with one piece of good news?
Please.
Okay, we'll have some good news. We are petitioning the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list the Yellowstone population as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act. We filed that petition in 2014. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ended up issuing a negative finding, meaning saying that they didn't warrant protection. However, in that finding, they didn't use all the best available science, as they are required to do, and so we sued them because of that decision. And in January, we had our day in court. Washington, D.C., a federal judge ruled in our favor, saying, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service picked and chose the science they wanted to use. That's not how this works. There's plenty of evidence here that suggests that they do warrant protection, and so he ruled that that finding would not stand. And then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service threatened to appeal that finding, and they withdrew that appeal just recently. So now they have to go back to the drawing board. They have 90 days to issue another finding. So we won round one of this very long battle for Endangered Species Act protection for the last wild buffalo.
And what is, so there's some good... what is the fish and wildlife argument primarily?
They think that there's enough buffalo. And they think that because there's so many buffalo on other public lands throughout the country, which are all, for the most part, managed as livestock, they think everything's fine. I mean, this country, their so-called greatest conservation success story is turning buffalo into livestock. That's what they think. That's what they think has been so successful. Oh, we saved the species. We turned them into livestock. So... there's a terrible mindset in relation to buffalo, and so the Fish and Wildlife Service is kind of looking at all these other populations that aren't wild, that aren't even genetically pure, and counting them among the last wild ones, the last ones to migrate, the last ones to live without fences, the last ones, well, not the last ones, but almost the last ones to not be contaminated with cattle genes. There's a lot of science that that challenges that, and that's the science that they didn't look at, and so now they have to go back and look at that.
So when you say that that the buffalo in other parks are treated as livestock, are there any other? You know, I'm hemming and hawing around because even the buffalo in Yellowstone are not, quote, allowed to migrate at will. So are there any other herds of buffalo anywhere in the country who are even remotely allowed to migrate, or are they basically all fenced in? I don't know the answer to this at all.
Well, most of them are fenced in. I'm not sure about the buffalo who were reintroduced up in Alaska. I'm not sure about those guys. There is the Henry Mountain herd down in Utah, and I don't know enough about them, but they don't have physical fences around them, but they are kind of geographically isolated. They're kind of in a place where they can't really migrate. They were put there. They came from Yellowstone. They were put there. But for the most part, half a million so-called, the more beefalo in this country, live behind fences. They're raised as livestock. They're privately owned, or the public herds who are managed, they're culled every year. I mean, so are the Yellowstone buffalo, but these are more seriously livestock management paradigms where they don't have as much land, they don't have the opportunity to migrate, and it's, ranching-style operations for the most part.
Is there, I know back in the 80s and 90s, the Buffalo Commons notion was really floated. Has that gained any traction whatsoever?
No, it hasn't. There's another effort that's going on. People are still talking about it, but nothing's really happened there.
Oh,
but
can you explain
another...
that very briefly?
What was that?
I just threw that term out, and listeners may not know. Can you explain the Buffalo Commons in, four sentences?
Yeah, it was basically all these ranches and farms that were kind of being abandoned and turning the buffalo, the land back over to the buffalo. And it was huge chunks of land, like vast, vast millions of acres. And it would have, you know, it would have been great, but nothing much has happened. But now there is another effort in northern Montana, the American Prairie Reserve, who they are buying up big ranches. And it's all willing stuff, but all these ranchers are having a fit over it, and they're taking down the fences and turning buffalo, or the land back over to buffalo. The buffalo are still fenced in, but as they acquired land, they're taking down the fences in between. Unfortunately, the buffalo that they have there are managed as alternative livestock, with the Department of Livestock having authority over them, as the Yellowstone buffalo also have. But the best news is that they're being really successful, and their vision is to create these massive tracks, these corridors that lead south down towards the Gardner Basin, and then west from the Hebgen Basin up north towards Glacier, and then back east. And we love that part. That part's really great because we need that to happen for the Yellowstone population, and that's the only other thing like that I know of that is currently taking place.
I know there were some discussions a long time ago, like decades ago, about tribes taking the lead on some of this. Are the indigenous nations working with those people that you just mentioned?
Yes. Not really. The American Prairie Reserve, I'm not sure how much they are involving the indigenous communities. They're very close to Fort Belknap and close to Fort Peck, but to my knowledge, they're not working as closely with them as they should be.
So tell me some other news from the past year.
Well, I guess another bit of good news that did happen this year is, so the trap that's inside Yellowstone National Park is a fortress. It's an industrial size, you know, glorified cattle corral operation. And the park has a 7-mile public closure around the facility. So it's hard to, you can't even see what's going on in there, much less, you know, trust Yellowstone to tell you. And they won't tell you. They don't tell you until weeks and weeks later.
Wait. Are you saying that on public lands that they are prohibiting people from approaching within 7 miles?
Yep.
Okay, I just want to point out that I have not heard that until this moment. And if you in California say, try to close any area to people riding off-road vehicles on public lands, they pitch a fit.
Right?
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so there's this huge closure around the park. And so it's very frustrating. I mean, I sued Yellowstone over to gain access to that facility so that we could see what's going on in there, because we know bad, really bad things are happening in there, and the public has a right to know. Lost the lawsuit after a couple of years, but ended up gaining a little bit of access. Of course, it's choreographed because it's organized by Yellowstone. They started doing these media tours, but even on the days when they're in charge of what we get to see, you still see some really terrible things.
Oh, I can barely look at the pictures that you've sent out. They're too heartbreaking.
So, yeah. That's what that's from. So we did get to show people what was going on in there, and that was, again, on a day when the world was watching. So they really toned it down. I can't even imagine what happens there when no public eye is on it. But anyway, so that trap is the bane of our existence. It's got to come down. And this year, it ended up being attacked 4 times, different times. On one occasion, somebodies went in and released 52 bulls who were being held for quarantine purposes. And on another occasion, when Yellowstone started capturing for slaughter, the trap was attacked again, and there was buffalo who were released. And unknown individuals again. And then later in the season, as the capture for slaughter operations really started, there were two gentlemen who had been with Buffalo Field Campaign at one time, who locked down inside the trap to the squeeze chute, which ironically is called the silencer, which they have spray painted over because people have seen it now. And they locked down to the squeeze chute, which drew a lot of media attention. It didn't stop the fodder, but it helped raise a lot of awareness and gave people a little bit of inspiration. And then a few weeks later, as the slaughter continued, there were two gentlemen who also had been formerly with Buffalo Field Campaign that locked down to the access road to the trap, to some concrete barrels. And so once again, the trap was attacked, and they were trying to block slaughter trucks from entering the park, the access road to the trap, to prevent them from going to get buffalo. And Yellowstone's response to that was to bulldoze another road and just drive around them. So that's how eager they are to ship buffalo to slaughter. But it put Yellowstone on notice that people are sick of this, that trap is not impenetrable, and yeah, so that happened. But at the same time, going into the winter, the park and all the agencies had decided, oh, we want to kill about 600 to 900 buffalo this year, and unfortunately, they continued to slaughter, and they ended up killing about 1,200 buffalo this year. So they went well over their own kill quota, even though those actions had taken place. And, you know, some of us think that it may have been in response to that.
Well, if any of those people are listening, not the people who slaughtered, but the people who fought against the trap, I would like to say thank you.
Yeah, they are heroes. And, they're absolute heroes.
So what other news in the past year, buffalo-related news from Yellowstone?
Well, we have had yet another quiet, wonderful spring with the buffalo over in the Hebgen Basin, because I talked about it before, the year-round habitat that we've gained. It's just been amazing that when buffalo are coming for spring migration, coming out to Horse Butte and the surrounding lands to have their babies, that we're not just on guard waiting for the Department of Livestock and the other agencies to show up to harass them. They just get to be buffalo. I mean, it's been, we've had just, two years, I think, full on of little calves being able to just be born and do their thing and get strong and move around like they need to, like they want to. Mom's taking their time. Just peace, tranquility, being buffalo. And it's, you know, we've been chasing down agents for so many years, it's still a little hard to get used to, and we're having to remind ourselves to celebrate and that this is really real and the boogeyman's not coming around the corner anytime soon. So that's been something that's exciting, and for those of us who have been around for a long time, we still can't believe it.
I was just going to say, people who didn't hear the previous interview might not know what hazing was.
Oh, hazing is it's abusive, brutal behavior that forces an individual or a family or group of buffalo, in this case, off of the ground that they choose to be on. And hazing buffalo, they used to use helicopters, they used to use snowmobiles, ATVs, crazy cowboys on horseback, law enforcement to protect all those guys while they're doing this terrible job, and pushing buffalo during the height of calving season. Pregnant moms who are just about to give birth, baby buffalo who've just been born, still wet, still wobbly on their legs, and pushing them for miles and miles and miles and miles off of their chosen ground and into Yellowstone out of Montana. And, I mean, that would take place day after day, week after week, because the buffalo would return. They know where they want to be, and they're going to return, and they do. But we would see so many injuries, moms and babies being separated, stillbirths because of the stress, and just, you know, fatalities even. And now it's quiet out there. For the most part, there's still some land where the buffalo aren't allowed to be, and we're working on that. But the hazing, I think we had maybe two hazing operations this year, and that was a total of like 12 buffalo at one point and another five at another point. So it's changed in that regard. The sad part is that this is in the Hebgen Basin where the central herd exclusively migrates into. And so because they're so imperiled and their population's been so diminished, we're not seeing the numbers of buffalo coming into that basin right now. And so it's like, you know, we threw a big fat party and nobody's showing up. And it's really terrifying because we used to see, you know, upwards of 600 buffalo or so in the basin in the springtime. And I think this year we hardly counted 200.
That is pretty scary.
Yep.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and
oh wow, that went by really fast.
So can you? I want to end in a few moments with how people can become associated with Buffalo Field Campaign. But before then, do you have any other news or any things that are going to be news within the next 6 months? Anything's happening?
Oh yeah, I wanted to talk about the Zinke thing real quick. Mike wanted me to mention that. So Dan Wink, who is a superintendent of Yellowstone, he's got buffalo blood all over his hands. We have been in a battle with him for a long time, just like every other superintendent of Yellowstone for the past 30 years. Yet, I guess him and Zinke, who is the Secretary of the Interior, who's also a Montana cattleman, a Trump appointee, and Wink got into a fight over something about buffalo. And so it's come out that Wink has now been ousted by Zinke. We don't exactly know much about who's going to replace him, but Zinke also has stated that he wants to drive the population down even further to 2,000 buffalo. So now we have a whole new battle on our hands with that. So we need help, and you can get involved. You can check us out on the internet at buffalofieldcampaign.org. Give us a call, 406-646-0070. We are a volunteer-based organization. Our field season runs mid-November to the end of May. We provide room, board, gear, and training, and you get to spend time in the field with wild buffalo. Some days are good, some days are really difficult, but it is rewarding work, and the buffalo need us to be there for them. And we run patrols in both the Gardner and Hebgen basins, and sometimes we're out on skis and snowshoes, sometimes we're unfortunately driving around a lot, other times we're hiking depending on the time of year, but we're always in the presence of wild buffalo, and it's one of the greatest gifts that I've ever been getting, to being able to do this work to defend them. And obviously things aren't going well, so we have to work even harder now, but some things have changed for the better, and we press on just like they do, with persistence, resistance, and endurance.
And people don't have to show up for the entire 6 months.
No, no. I mean, we try to ask people to give about 2 weeks of their time, but we never turn anybody away. If somebody can just only come even for a day or two, that's fine. But some people come and they never leave. Some people come for a whole season. Some people come for a month. I never left.
And
I'm going into my 16th season next year.
And also, and we've talked about this before, those who are not 25 years old and capable of snowshoeing all day, or 50 years old and capable of snowshoeing all day, there still is room for people who are not, well, hell, I couldn't snowshoe all day. So there would still be room for somebody like me.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's stuff to do around the cabin. There's, you know, there's like the patrols in Gardner you could totally do. I mean, there's stuff. Yes, yes, come. We can use the help.
And I just want to say also that I know several people who have gone to volunteer at BFC, and every single one of them has said that it was one of the most wonderful and life-changing things they've ever done in their lives.
It's so great, and I know exactly what you're talking about, and we have had so many DGR folks in the house at BFC in the past few years, and it's just been awesome. And I'm really glad that they're having those experiences, and I know there's folks that are going to be coming back, and it's been great to have that solidarity in the field.
So is there anything else you want to say about Buffalo or BFC before we wait to the next interview we do?
always be yourself. If you can't be yourself, be a bison.
Well, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for saying that, and thank you. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Stephanie C. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio and the Progressive Radio Network.